If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Say Why to Drugs. Thank you all so much for the lovely messages you sent me about the CBD episode. I'm really glad you guys enjoyed that because I was really pleased with it as well. And thanks again to Amir England for being such a great guest. This episode is another real treat with a really great guest. A few months ago, I was lucky enough to be able to have a chat with Adam Fychek, the drummer from Baby Shambles and a psychotherapist. We spoke in the cafe at the Wellcome Trust and talked about all sorts of things, from what psychotherapy is to whether musicians might be particularly prone to developing substance use problems, all via Adam's fascinating journey detailing why he wanted to become first a musician and then a psychotherapist. So without further ado, Adam Fychek and I say why to drugs and music and a host of other things.
My name is Adam Fychek. I am a professional musician, psychotherapist, and I like to think of myself as an informal music psychologist as well.
Excellent. Well, I guess the first thing I'd like to ask you about is the psychotherapy. So
yeah.
Do you work specifically with musicians, is that right?
Well, I do. I launched an initiative probably about 4 or 5 years ago before I'd started my training as a psychotherapist, which was based around more coaching strategies or just some support, almost peer support from somebody that had been through the music industry from a frontline perspective as a musician. And also DIY releasing and insight into the managerial situation as well, because there was a time when I was managing Baby Shambles infrastructure very poorly, but I got a great overview of what was needed in that situation. So I feel I can kind of bring all those different elements into it.
And what type of issues do musicians who come and see you tend to have?
I think it varies. I think it's not really a specific struggle from musicians. I think there are innately challenging environmental conditions when you're a musician, especially a professional musician on the road. But most of the time, most of those external environmental struggles, they tend to clash with what people bring to the industry themselves as well. So most of the struggles I see are kind of a mixture of both environmental and, I guess, intrapersonal and intrapsychic. So all of those things together, rather than the industry is causing this problem. I generally think if most people have, I mean, I look at it sometimes from an attachment perspective, or they have a secure sense of self, then they can better handle those environmental conditions. So I'm always quite reluctant to point the finger at the industry and say, you know, there's the problem. I think there are inherent problems with it, with the commoditisation or the objectification, but I do generally think that people come into the industry a certain way, and how that way is, the impact of the industry will have different outcomes. So.
And then in terms sort of specifically of substance use, is that something you see at particularly high levels in the musicians?
It is, yeah, it differs really. Some musicians I work with are not so much using substances to regulate their affects. Some are, some aren't, different types of drugs as well. I guess some of the people that are less energised, they can use certain types of drugs to energise themselves, and some that are over-regulated, hyper-aroused, can then use certain drugs to destimulate. So different, again, different.
And do you think that's something specific, that the way musicians use drugs?
I don't think so. I think you can lean it into creatives, you can lean it into what kind of impetus creatives have to actually create, whether or not they need certain drugs. I don't know. I mean, I can tie that back into the environmental stuff. I think there are certain environmental factors that would lead to certain drugs being used. But I'm not sure if it's the musician themselves.
Mm. No, I suppose what I was trying to get at is it's something certainly that, from an outsider perspective, musicians seem to be a group of people who are perhaps given a bit of a free pass around substance use, whereas if I were to go to my job, even drunk, I would probably get in quite a lot of trouble or use my drug, lose my job. But for musicians, there seems to be almost an encouragement, certainly a kind of acceptance that, well, you know, it's the rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah, I think we've seen a bit of a downward turn in that in recent times. I think people are much more health conscious. I also believe this is a cultural phenomenon that ties into, you know, we go back to rock and roll, we go back to what it actually meant, you know, the birth of the teenager in the 50s. And you've got, I guess, you know, rock and roll from the States coming over. Then you've got the classic Beatles and the Stones. And I think a huge shift in how the teenager was created almost was part of that rebellious nature, which tied into the recorded music industry. So therefore, I think a lot of that ties into that, you know, this kind of archaic how we view rock and roll. And I think now we're at a time where rock and roll isn't all that there is, you know. I guess up until probably when genres were splitting, predominantly probably with the advance of technology, then we've got, you know, we've got electronic, we've got disco, we've got all these different facets coming together into the modern music world. I think rock and roll and probably other genres, yeah, are more informed by what we perceive as drug use and the romanticisation of some of that stuff. But I do think that kind of comes from a cultural shift in teenagers and natural rebellion, which is shifting now.
Yeah. Now, obviously, I'm going to might ask you some questions. If you don't want to answer them, then that's absolutely fine, and I can just cut it completely out of the podcast.
Yeah, cool.
But I'm really interested in why you wanted to become a psychotherapist.
Oh, right, okay.
And I suppose particularly given the band that you were in, Baby Shambles, was a band with a bit of a reputation.
We're going to go and do more stuff.
Oh, fantastic. I didn't realise. But obviously, it's like Pete in particular. Is maybe one of the last kind of bastions of rock and roll lifestyle.
Because I often wonder what that means. You know, I see some people online, you know, rock and roll, and with that statement, and I often ask them, what does that mean to you? Because I think it's quite phenomenological. What does rock and roll mean to you?
Yeah.
Because to me, it meant something very different. It meant for me, rock and roll was an outlet for me to get away from, I guess, you know, my quite an impoverished, neglectful background. So the romanticisation of going against authority, and that was appealing to me. But the rock and rollness, I always think I'm more probably, I don't know, more jazz than rock and roll in a way, because rock and roll to me meant, I don't know, it wasn't something that was so alluring as maybe some other people. Well, rock and roll, it's my rock and roll, you know, like it's your rock and roll.
Yeah.
I think it has such a phenomenological quality to it that, what does it mean to you? But, you know, in the context of you were saying there, I can't remember the question.
It was partly sort of why did you want to become a psychotherapist?
Why, okay.
And did you ever have any kind of problems yourself, or did you see problems in your bandmates that made you sort of become particularly interested in this topic?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if I reframe that as rather than problems, I guess inherent struggles. I think, as I spoke about before, growing up in an environment which was neglectful, impoverished. I grew up in quite a fast lifestyle. There was some, from looking back now with my new lens, I think there were some substance issues. So my background definitely projected me into a place of feeling quite wounded, not really knowing it, because that was my framework. And then music for me was a huge outlet. It really soothed me. It gave me some kind of cultural identity. It gave me a way out, because I'd left school at whatever, I don't know, 18. My highest grade was like a C in geography. Everything else, failed everything else. So I was doing what was still a YTS back then. During that, I was involved with mild criminal activity, and I got pulled up on it. So my life started to spiral further and further down. And I was, you know, I was using substances just to self-regulate and self-soothe. And it was on a very fast, dark trajectory downwards. I was taking probably the only area where I felt I had some control was through substance using. From that, I managed to find a springboard to go and do a BTEC in music at 19. So I was quite an old cohort, really. And I went to Essex and done a BTEC with mostly a lot younger than me. But I, for the first time, I felt that I could do something and achieve something. So I found music from that age. Because I knew no one there, generally in a college environment, people kind of come together from the local environment. And I think that I didn't know anyone. So I would just practice and practice and practice. Looking back, probably unhealthily, again, in an attempt to regulate myself. But workaholism has a much more morally praised value in our society. So come out of that 2 years with a sense of worth, thinking, hold on, I can actually do something. Culturally, you know, that was a time of Britpop, so I was really, wow, this is something I'm really into. And academically, thinking, hold on, if I do this, then I can go and do a degree. And in my world, a degree was this holy grail. A degree? You know, no one in my family had done that. And none of my friends have done it. So this, the degree, expecting to finish the BTEC, come home and back to Milton Keynes I grew up in, take a few years out and polish whatever I was doing. But I managed to get onto a jazz degree, finish that, then got onto a PGCE to study secondary school music because I felt like I really want to be a musician, but I have to be practical here. I don't really have any other financial support, so I've got to support myself. So undertook the training, was a school teacher for a number of years, and kind of, I still felt wounded, but I felt okay enough. And then was in lots of different bands. I started an MA in music education because thinking, okay, if I'm going to be a musician, I can keep building that, but also I want to build my academic infrastructure. And then during that, I was in one of my bands, and one of the bands took off. And that was Baby Shambles, and that went on for probably a good 10 years, touring the world, you know, being shaken up all over the place. And then coming through the other side of that, really hitting the floor with a bit of a crash. Again, you know, my life was like 100 miles an hour. I was moving so fast. And really struggling emotionally from that, working out who I was anymore, because I'd been on this journey. A lot of my old wounds kind of coming back up. I think I was in the middle of a grief. My mother had died the same time that I joined the band, so I'm holding two things. I'm holding this innately sad, I can't even begin to describe, this sense of loss, and I'm holding this amazing opportunity, life-changing opportunity, this anomaly. So I didn't really deal with the grief. So when I come through the other end of that, I really struggled, I think, trying to process all that happened from the trauma of being in the band and the excitement and probably some of the trauma from my previous life. These things tend to come up in those moments and connects all of those strands of fragmentation. So I was in quite a bad place. So I was seeking therapy myself. I struggled to find a therapist that really understood. I saw a few and they were in the arts. And I'd sit in front of them and I felt they didn't really understand the perspective of being not just a musician, somebody that put so much time and effort into their musicality, but then having that commoditized, so that then warps and tarnishes it slightly. And my background as well. So it was quite a unique experience. So I struggled to find a therapist that could understand those elements. So after about 4 years in therapy, I'd previously done a master's in music technology, so I wanted to more, rather than be on the road, I wanted to get more involved with recording. And towards the end of that, I was thinking about my next step and I was going to do music therapy. And I realised that being a music therapist, as much as I would love to do it, and I still would, I thought career-wise, it'd be quite difficult then to work in the field as anything other than a music therapist. And I was really interested for my own therapy and lots of the reading I was doing. So then the master's kind of slightly... It shifted into my last thesis was about the emotional content of how music production can impact us and impact other people. So there's all that stuff going on. So that was leading me somewhere. And then started to explore through friends who were therapists and through my own therapist, my own therapy and my own struggles, my own wounds, about training to be one. So that was my journey. That's how I got to that point, really. So from lived experience, from the value I got out of that in the therapy content, but also from being a professional musician. But not just being a professional musician, because I work with professional musicians, and I think there's one thing of if you're a corporate musician, so you're out, you're working, I mean, that can be incredibly stressful. But then you superimpose that in the professional music industry where you're being commoditized. And I don't mean that in a negative sense. I think we all need that to make money from our art. And then if you add a third element, which is fame and more psychosocial aspects, you know, we were lucky, unlucky enough to be in the public eye when bands were, you know, the swing of the popular music pendulum was towards bands, so we were kind of thrust upon that. And all that that entails as well is incredibly validating for me, somebody that struggled with a sense of worth, to suddenly be signed an autograph and stuff like that. It was really important for me. And one of my big struggles is coming through that. The biggest loss initially for me was where am I going to get that validation from now? Because the wound that was already there had grown considerably. So, you know, having to unpick all these things that I got out of the industry, all these losses that are no longer there, it was incredibly rewarding for me to reconstruct it and sit down and play a guitar and go, oh, God, I'm really moved by this. So, you know, pulling apart all those different aspects led me to train. And I always knew that at some point I wanted to put together all of my musical training and all of my psychotherapy training and psychology insight into a doctorate, which would combine all of those things, which I'm just about to embark on now. So I feel like it's kind of a nice completion, about to evolve, but still being a musician, still at heart, I'm a musician. You know, I practice every day. I still want to release. I still get excited about touring, albeit on a smaller level. Still very passionate about it, really. So that's how I ended up here.
God, when do you have any free time?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, not much. Yeah.
What do you kind of do as a psychotherapist then? So if a client comes to see you, what would the process be of working with them?
It depends on the person, I think. You know, it's so unique. I think if you ask any psychotherapist or counsellor, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
It's working with what's in the room, and people are very different. And also, I'm always aware, because I'm an integrative psychotherapist from a relational training, it's about me as well. It's about how do I impact this person? What goes on from my experience, because it's a mutual engagement. You know, I work in what we call two-person psychology. It's not the doer and done to, it's like a joint process. Of course, I've got experience and I have enough insight to be able to really use myself as an instrument to think, well, this person's impacting me like this. I wonder if they impact other people like this, and that's part of their struggle. And in a safe time or a safe space, offer that. You know, that might cause a rupture, and then we'll work with that.
Because some people who listen to this podcast will probably never have experienced psychotherapy or won't necessarily know anything about it at all. So is there a specific sort of set session time? Like, is it just you and this other person in the room?
It's just us two, yeah.
Just talking.
Yeah.
That's basically the sort of...
It's talking. It's also exploring the other person's way of being, how they've constructed their narrative, how they view themselves in relationship, how they view themselves internally. And there's different meta theories, you know. I as part of my model, I heard the meta theory, I hold it of like trauma as well, because I think something like trauma, when we've experienced trauma growing up, it's more than just talking about it and processing. It can be quite embodied, and it can be quite a felt sense. So it sometimes goes beyond that. And regarding length of time, it depends, A, what the person wants and what they're struggling with. And I'd suggest to them, well, you know, if you've come from a highly dysfunctional background and this has been happening and building over a number of years, you might need a bit longer, but you may need to just, or you may want to just work on this aspect, and that's fine. And even if we don't have to go into the depths of some of your struggles, as long as you make some progress in terms of how you can understand your own experience, I think that's potent enough, really. Sometimes for different people, you know, different people want different things.
And if we could talk a bit about substance use, because obviously this is a podcast particularly about drugs. When people come to see you with substance use problems, what would a sort of successful therapy kind of look like? Would you be trying to help someone completely stop, or would you be trying to help someone manage their relationship with substances differently? Or, I mean, I guess it could be either or, potentially.
I mean, the most important thing is for them to get some insight into why they're doing it. From my perspective, I think substance use comes from dysregulation. So people trying to either locate emotional experiences, not have emotional experiences, almost in a creative way. It's a creative adjustment to try to find something outside of yourself, to fix something inside of yourself. So for me, it's about insight. It's about, well, why are you doing this? And I can come from two perspectives. I can get quite existential and I can say, well, look, you know, you're taking this drug every week. What's the impact of that? And someone says, well, there's no impact. I say, well, is this a problem for you? Well, yeah, because of my health. Okay, so this way up, it's motivational. So yes, you can carry on taking drugs. That's fine. That's if that's what you want to do and create your way of being. But what is the cost? You know, what's the profit and loss? And some people then come to their own realization of maybe they don't want to give up just yet. Okay, but the potential profit is I might lose my life. And then we can explore if it is something that somebody wants some resourcing with and behaviourally they're saying, I really want to stop. And if they're also admitting that they have got a problem, then we can look at resourcing, and I think there's behavioural resources. I think there's like the fellowships, if people want to engage with that. So 12-step meetings, there's also smart recovery. And again, it's what people want. And the other part of that is some people come in and they don't really want to admit that they've got a problem. And again, that's okay. Well, say, well, okay, could you abstain for 90 days? Yeah, no problem. If they can, say, well, okay, well, let's talk about what's going on there. That's fine. So what triggers you? Then they can work on their own triggers. Or if they can't, then it's like, well, so this is clear that this is a behavioural pattern and it's a habit, so we need to put some behavioural strategies in, and then we can get involved with other behavioural strategies, whether that's kind of cognitive, whether that's fellowship stuff. It depends on the person. You know, I think we're all so unique. Some people don't want to go near fellowships. Then we can explore that. So grist for the mill. So what is it? You know, you tried one meeting out to say CA, Cocaine Anonymous, it just didn't feel right. And even from going, there's insight. You know, I just didn't get up with the people. Is that because you felt that you held too much shame to actually embrace them as them with a similar struggle? And then there's that. So if it's shame holding you back, let's go in and see, well, where did shame first start? I think it's quite, it's too vast. I think we're all so different. And I think from my approach, which is really quite subjective and, you know, person to person, the whole, I guess, the eye of thou perspective of quite humanistic in a way, it's too easy to say, you're an addict, this is what you have to do. I think there is an element of that we have to embrace. If people then are open around and say, I need some structuring, I need some behavioural elements. But it's, I think we're too unique in a way.
And this is one point where I wonder whether there might be something about sort of musicians and the kind of the places that being a musician puts you that might make it hard to deal with substance use. So, for example, if you're playing gigs, you will almost certainly be playing them in venues where that are licensed and selling alcohol. Yeah. I mean, I've been in bands for many years, and I've never ever, even in the rubbishest venues where we were being paid nothing, I've never ever not been offered free booze. And potentially other things as well. Mm. I can see how if you are beginning down a sort of spiral of problematic substance use, that particular job could
make it more problematic. It's much closer to where you don't want to be sailing, really. And yeah, behavioural resourcing, if you're struggling from an addiction, then we would say try to stay away, you know, try to stay away from a wet place. But you're right, as a musician, I think it does make it inherently more difficult. There are resourcing we can put in place in terms of, okay, well, it's your choice, do you want to go to the after show or not? Because you're going to be adrenalised, you know, cortisol is going to be flying around your body. So in that respect, your prefrontal cortex is going to be offline. So you're going to be talked into something probably. And again, it's that thing, we could go hard round about it and say, do not go there. We could say, well, it's kind of your choice. I know, and I don't know whether you agree, in terms of the client, you're going to be what I call offline after that gig. You're going to be full of all sorts of stuff going around you. Just, you know, natural body hormones. Do you think that going there is a good idea? No. Okay, well, how can then we structure that? Okay, let's speak to your tour manager, who's going to say to you, you're not going to go. But if you keep pushing and start threatening him with getting the sack, then you're going to ultimately go to this after show. I mean, it's just a small example. But I try not to infantilise, you know, I try to say, look, you're going to have to at some point take some agency over this. Because if you don't, then it's to your detriment, if that's what you're suggesting. But yeah, I think there's inherent environmental stressors that are going to make it a lot harder as a musician.
And I guess coming from the other side of sort of someone who listens to music, we do see that drug taking occurs more at music festivals, or people say that they like to listen to music when they're intoxicated and all that kind of thing. Like, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think drugs and music go together?
I think there's a higher sensitization with certain drugs and certain music. Whether or not they go together, I think, again, it's down to a personal taste, because you could take a certain drug, listen to a certain BPM of music, and it's going to have the adverse effect. Because if you take something which is going to, something's going to stimulate you, and then you want to listen to something very chilled and ambient, it's not going to have the same effect, unless you like that discombobulation going on. So yeah, I think there probably is. It's like a food, isn't it? It's like if you want to have a certain affect, you can take a certain food and watch some stimulating film to increase that affect. But I think the biggest part of my work also is working with the affect in the body. It's like, well, do you even know? Have you ever? And you know, we live in a time of mindfulness, and I think it's such an important resource without all the cliché. And being mindful about, well, do you even know how you feel right now? Do you even know how you feel once you've had a kind of coke? You know, can you feel that? Because I think most of us are oblivious to that in a way. Well, lots of us that have suffered from dysphoria, I know I was initially, it took me 2 years of therapy to know what emotion was, you know, and another 2 years to process that, and it's ongoing. But I think when we haven't been lucky enough to have any emotional regulation from our caregivers, we really struggle with that. And also, I do think lots of musicians, it's like chicken and egg, lots of musicians are drawn to music initially as a source of regulation. So in the pool of musicians, we are going to find probably a high percentage of people that are quite dysregulated anyway, emotionally, because they've used music as a soother. You know, whether that's attachment, a transitional object, any of these psycho terms, they've used it as a resource. So therefore, if you're using it as a resource, you need something external anyway. And then maybe the jump from using music to smoking a bit of weed, it's a bit of a continuum. So I think there are a larger percentage of people that are musicians that probably are slightly musically regulated anyway.
And I want to pick up on something that you said earlier as well, that musicians are perhaps getting a bit more, or people in general, are perhaps getting a bit more kind of health conscious.
Yeah.
Is that something that you've noticed? Because obviously your band Baby Shambles kind of came to prominence just at that, the kind of height of this sort of, I don't know what to call it really, but kind of like the end of Britpop and what came after it, and sort of,
yeah,
2001 certainly was the height of like lad culture, and certainly,
yeah,
like young people drinking, that's the highest rate of sort of the history of
the
drinking being,
wow,
measured.
Wow, I thought it'd been, yeah, before that. How interesting.
Certainly among young people anyway.
On the internet.
Well, it's very interesting now that young people certainly drinking and perhaps other substance use as well does seem to be going down again.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that
mental
something,
health is rising.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's very unusual pattern. Mm. Is that something that you noticed?
Yeah, I think I've noticed generally an increase in awareness of physical health, and there's a part of me that believes that to be more aesthetic. I think we live in a culture now where everything's visual, so people want to look their best. You know, most of it is all filtered anyway, it's synthetic. But I think people now, you know, if we see the growth in health foods and supplements and gyms and gym wear, it's phenomenal. And I think a lot of the bands now, a lot of young people generally from a certain demographic are very influenced by that visual aspect, that aesthetic. And I think that definitely ties into it. I don't think there's been a huge sweep in terms of anything else. That's my perspective, that because we live in a very much more synthetic, aesthetic environment, people want that perception to be looking healthier. Because healthier means I'm more attractive if my muscles are bigger, or if my, you know, my tan is glowier and my figure is more svelte. And that's, you know, that's what we live in, those times. I think if you're a certain generation, it's much more important, I think. So I think then that would probably lean you against drinking too much, taking too many drugs, because you're going to be doing, you know, getting photographed. Something might propel you to go the other way as an anomaly, where you just go, fuck that, and I'm going to go as dirty and dingy and as messed up as I can. But I do think the cultural implication of the aesthetic, the synthetic aesthetic world we live in, has had a massive impact on everything, from music to every, I think, every aspect of culture. Yeah.
And am I right that do you work mostly private, or do you do
no,
any
No, I work
NHS
in a centre as well. I stopped NHS last summer. It's probably certainly going to be starting again very soon. But I was working as a psychotherapist. It wasn't in addictions. It was just with people that refer to primary care.
Yeah.
So.
And in terms of, if you were going to sort of get, try and see a psychotherapist through the NHS,
mm,
is that quite a straightforward process, or is it?
It's becoming easier. I think, like anything, resourcing was a struggle. But I was lucky enough, I was based in North London. Our waiting list was, but it's longer, 6 weeks. We'd get people in within 2 weeks. Sometimes we'd discombobulate people. We'd be like, wow, I saw my GP last week and you want me in. We were lucky enough to have a very fluid practice and it's quite well resourced. I hear of people waiting for months and months. So I think the first port of call, yeah, is GP. I would assume GP, but there are, you know, there's Mind. There's these places where you can get very reduced fee therapy. And there are kind of, around London, there are very numerous resources, I think, where you can get reduced fee therapy. A GP is always a good resource, and depending on where you live, it's going to take longer or shorter, really.
So, last question. From your personal experience of some knowing musicians, but also from your experience of working with musicians in psychotherapy, are there any key aspects of clients or their circumstances that need to be better understood by the kind of addiction research community in general, and also other therapists and other people helping to treat musicians specifically, that could improve the treatment or the tailoring of their treatment?
I think an understanding of the environment, I think the understanding of what it's actually like to be on a tour bus, I think it's very difficult. I think people can ponder it and talk about, you know, I know a lot of music industry therapists, and I guess in that, I'm quite an anomaly. I'm the only one who's probably been on tour. and been subject to what it's really like. Most of the music industry therapists in London anyway come from a background of the infrastructure, so the more commoditized network. And I think it's a very different experience if you've been working in, for example, a marketing department. I think it's just as important, but it's not the same experience as is being a musician. Because, you know, if I take about my experience, I'm holding that music is very key to my core. So the very essence of touching an instrument, of engaging with music on that level, and we take away the periphery of the commoditized nature of it. So that is my very essence. And then we put that in that environment, which is incredibly demanding, the conditions of it, the dysregulation of performing, the touring, there's so many attributes which we know. And then, as I said also, the psychosocial aspect of what that does, what that did for me, you know, raised my sense of worth, and that was all over the place, and fame, status, you know, my own wounds were kind of being patched up in that place. So one thing I would say is trying to connect with the real visceral experience of what it's like to be not only a musician, because that's hard enough. I often think being a musician is really hard, because there's no one to say, yeah, that's good, that's bad, you don't know where you are with it. It's an innate drive that I feel that I have to do. So it's both a blessing and a curse. I have to play an instrument every day. For me, whether that's regulation or something else on a transpersonal level, who knows? So that's hard enough. Trying to make a living out of that is double hard. And then making a living out of that is an amazing opportunity. And I'm always quick to say, yeah, it was an amazing opportunity, but there were inherent triggers for me which caused me to struggle. The understanding of the complexity of that, I think, sometimes is overlooked. I think even the very part that you're a musician, it's almost like the very objectification, which I think leads to more distress, is almost implemented on people looking at, oh, he's a musician in the industry. It's like, it goes deeper than that. You know, it's more than that. You're not just a thing. You're an organic, subjective experience that has got different levels of struggle going on. And I think that insight to those areas is often overlooked, I think.
I think objectification is a key word there, because we, as kind of outsiders, look at musicians and we see a very specific side of it. We see the public side, we see the gigs, we see the after shows, we see the like photos of people falling out of taxis, or you know, all of this kind of thing. What we don't see is the driving for hours in a tour, or hours, days, weeks, months in a tour bus, not really seeing people other than your like bandmates, management, arriving at a venue, having then hours to kill before sound check, where you eat, sort of where you sleep, all of this kind of thing that is the kind of reality of touring. It can be quite boring. Repetitive.
I agree, I mean, I got incredibly bored. We're touring the same album for 3 years. It's like, as an improviser as well, I got incredibly, felt quite boxed in. But I think culturally our bands become what we want them to be. And it's one of those interesting things. It's my experience in the industry has totally shifted my perspective. I met all of my idols, all these people I grew up with, and thought, wow. And I realised that I'd created, it was a, and again, you know, kind of quoting the Martin Buber-esque-ness, it was, I'd created this idea. I'd created an object to be what I wanted them to be. And they weren't that person. That's not who they are. I mean, we can never be, unless we sit down and probably have years of personal therapy with that person, then we can really see each other. But the other interesting area of what you just said there, again, you know, we marked all these environmental kind of factors, but, you know, we also don't see, you know, for myself, there was a time when I was doing 9 hours a day practice, you know, and that was, it was both a blessing. It was, I think it was an addictive process. It was incredibly regulating. It was incredibly dysregulating in terms of my social and interpersonal commitments. It was very destructive. There's all that of being a musician as well, which again kind of gets overlooked, because you're a musician and you've been put in a framework where people are objectifying you to get what they want out of you. And of course, that needs to happen because you need to be commoditized. You need to generate income. And the only way somebody is going to invest in you is if they can psychologically create a malleability in what you offer for them to buy into, if that makes sense. So I think there's all those aspects. And my biggest thing I work with musicians is, we talk about the commoditized nature of the industry, but not in a dirty way, not in a dismissive or the industry way. It's like, well, hold on, you need this. Because if you want to be sitting in your bedroom and doing 5 hours a day and making abstract art, that's brilliant, that's great. If you want to make some money from it, then that's a different matter. You can be true to your own self and make art for you, and that's great. But if you want to step outside of that, you have to be commoditized. And part of that is you're going to have to be malleable, and you're going to have to do some things that aren't conducive or congruent with who you feel you are. But who you feel you are probably isn't who the person that's buying your records think you are. Now, it's great if we can acknowledge that and we can say, right, that's great, because then you're protected in a way. Because everyone goes and goes, yeah, I'm just being me, man. So you're not. Because even if you are, you're being filtered through whatever it is, media articles. You know, we're all filtered, whatever we do. So it's, for me, a lot of understanding is a bit more existential with artists. Like, well, let's look at you. Let's get some understanding of your way of being and your narrative. Let's see now that the safest way for you to contain and preserve that presence inside an area where you're going to have to bend slightly to sell your product. And it's about, I think people don't acknowledge that enough as artists. You know, they don't really get that insight into saying, well, here, this is me. If I want to sell a million records, I need to get to there. But maybe I don't. Maybe it's a continuum. If I want to sell 100 records. And for me and my journey, I brought it right the way back. And I'm lucky enough now to have a very small fan base. I can tour when I want to tour. I can release when I want to release. And I can make the music I want to make. And if they don't buy, I don't care. And that sounds really quite bigoted, but it's not. I really don't. Because it's not my source of income now. And when I do, probably when I do a lot of DJing stuff, yeah, there's less so. Because I'm playing to a crowd. I don't know how many truly authentic musicians there are that are existing in the commercial world. Probably none.
It's pretty difficult.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention as well, I was incredibly lucky. You know, I don't want to come across as being, I guess, ungrateful, because I think it's some of our journeys, and even the journeys that evoke wounds or create wounds, as long as we're lucky enough to try to process those wounds and heal them to an extent or to a greater extent, I think it's a process of growth for all of us. But I just think the music industry is a lot more in depth than some people kind of give it its credit for. And I think amongst all the music industry, there's a musician. You know, amongst that musician, there's a human being. Because we can kind of tear down, can't we? So if I'm sitting in NHS with just a person, they're never just a person, they've got their whole lives. But then we frame that, oh, you're an artist, you're a musician. We frame that in a commoditized music industry. And we frame that in terms of fame. So suddenly you've got all these layers up. And all of those unique layers will interact in different ways. And I think just holding that awareness or the intention to try to explore some of that stuff is key. Whenever we are thinking about that as therapists, but on the other side of that, maybe the people that I love listening to, I don't want all that. I just want them to be an object for me. So it's those two things, isn't it?
That seems like a brilliant place to wrap it up. So
cool.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
For your time.
No, it's okay.
Absolutely brilliant.
Great.
And there we go. If you enjoyed that conversation, you can find a little bit more of this interview over at the other podcast I make, Addiction Audio, for the scientific journal Addiction. I also asked Adam a few questions about theories and treatment options, and you can find that conversation over on the Addiction Journal SoundCloud page. I've put a link in Acast as well. The next episode of Say Why to Drugs is similarly music-themed, and it's the second live episode that we've done, and it was recorded a few months ago at the Smithdown Road Festival in Liverpool. So join me again in 2 weeks' time for that, and bye for now!
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.